Hello, I'm Paola, and welcome to Contemplative Revolution, a podcast by the WCCM, about what it means to live a contemplative, spiritual, and Christian life while still playing an active role in our modern world. Join us for conversations with fellow contemplatives in action from around the globe. This is the opening talk of the John Main Seminar 2015, which took place in New Zealand. Lawrence Freeman here explores why we meditate in itself and how we understand meditation as a spiritual path in this day and age. You can find the full content from the event on the WCCM website offering section.
Well, the theme of the retreat is it sounds a little prosaic, really. Meditation as a modern spiritual path. But I'd like to explore why we meditate in itself, and why we how we meditate, and how we understand meditation as a spiritual path in this day and age. This is a very ancient tradition. You can trace it back to the dawn of human consciousness, 40,000 years ago, at least. And we find meditation at the heart of all the great religious traditions, which began to take their present shape in that period we call the Axial Age, about 500 years before Christ, the era of the Hebrew prophets and the Buddha and Confucius and the Upanishads. And meditation is rolled over, the meditation is passed on, it's a tradition. The word tradition means a handing on, like a relay race. And we have received this great universal human wisdom from way back. And we ourselves are part of that chain of events which is passing it on to the next generation. And we're very conscious of that in our community because of the work we do with teaching meditation to children. But we do that, although there's something timeless about meditation, it's also very much enculturated, and I'm sure David is going to open up that meaning of the present historical context in which we live a spiritual path. So that's what I'd like to reflect on during the retreat, but the real purpose of the retreat is to give us a chance to enter into a stronger and a deeper silence and to become more fully present. Now, the first thing to make that possible is you have to want to do it, which I think is why you've come on the retreat before the seminar. You have to want to do it, and then secondly, we each need to make a little effort to make that happen and to respect the other people who want it as well. So to help them. If we see ourselves as helping each other to come into this silence and into this presence, then it will be a successful retreat. Even if you forget everything that I've said in my talks, the quality of silence, the quality of presence, the friendship that grows out of that during these few days of retreat, and the times of meditation themselves will do their work, and we will be enriched and changed by that. But even though there's this timeless element to meditation, we're also always meditating as human beings within the frame of our own lives. We don't know, we pretty well know where we began. We fill out our date of birth often enough on forms. We don't know what the final date at the other end is going to be. Makes life interesting. But we live our journey of meditation within that frame of our own personal lives. But of course, we also live it as historical beings, members of a particular culture in a particular era. I came across an interesting discovery recently the International Commission on Stratigraphy. But you don't even know what stratigraphy is, do you? You're so ignorant. Well, stratigraphy, as I discovered, is that branch of geology that studies the strata, you know, the layers of rocks that make up the record of our planet. And this International Commission on Stratigraphy decides what to name the period that we're living in. And it calls our era the Anthropocene era, which means the era which has been dominated by the human. We are having an intense influence on our environment and on our planet. And because of this major impact of human life on Earth, we are no longer living in what they used to call the Holocene period, that sort of this integrated period where all the different systems of the planet work together. Now that sort of holistic period has given way to this one where the human dominates and influences the systems, the delicate balance of the planet. Through our population explosion, through our fossil fuels, through the demands of made on water supply, on the destruction of habitats, the loss of species, and the debris of civilization, the waste, the atomic fallout, and the indestructible mountains of plastic that we create. So that's one way of understanding this era, this period of history that differentiates us from other times. It's one of the things we mean by modern. But as we explore that and the significance of that fact, no denying that we are in this new era where the human is dominating the planet and influencing it, threatening it, we discover that there is an even deeper significance or characteristic of this era, which is the importance of human self-understanding. It has never been more important than that human beings understand themselves in order to be able to shape the future. There's a Chinese saying which might sound pretty obvious at first, which is that if you are going in a certain direction and you don't do something to change it, then you will get to where you are going. Very profound, isn't it? So unless we make a decision, unless we decide to change direction, we will end up pretty much in the direction which we're heading. So it's our self-understanding that is going to change that. Self-knowledge is the most important thing we have to produce today. The desert teachers of the Christian tradition, the early monks, the men and women of the Egyptian desert especially, who gave us our way of meditation back in the 4th, 5th centuries. The desert monks used to say self-knowledge is more important to gain and develop than the ability to work miracles. Self-knowledge is more important than miracles. And we live in an age of miracles. You know, it's... You think of what happened in the last 60 years, from the first manned flight to landing on the moon, 60 years, pretty incredible. So we live in an age of immense change and miraculous technology. But more important than the miracles, one iPhone has more computing power than the spaceship that took the men to the moon. So this age of miracles is amazing and wonderful to celebrate, and it has done some very good things as well. But more important than that is our own self-knowledge. And that leads us into the era and the whole area of mystery. Einstein said that the most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. Imagination, he says, is more important than knowledge. And Muhammad said, "He who knows himself knows God," which is also the basis of Christian mystical theology. Self-knowledge is the foundation of our knowledge of God. And I think it's important to understand that, to bring that to mind as we reflect on the intensely painful and frightening events and tragedies in France in the last few days, and the massive trauma that has created globally. We need that self-knowledge to be able to keep it in perspective without in any way diminishing its importance. On the 24th of August 1572, the Catholics went on a rampage in Paris, St. Bartholomew's Day, and killed at least 3,000 Protestants. And the next few days, this sort of Congo-like or Rwanda-like massacre spread throughout France, and many more thousands of Protestants were massacred. So one of the things that we come to see as we grow in self-knowledge are the patterns of our experience. We notice this, I think, as we meditate, we begin to grow in psychological self-knowledge, self-awareness. We begin to be aware of the patterns of our own mind, some of the obsessive, repetitive patterns that we get compulsive about, our anxieties, our obsessions, our addictions, our fears, our fantasies, the things we chew over and over again, like the replay of old TV shows. But we can also see these patterns, and we need to see these patterns, in our culture, in our world, in our society, the pattern of violence, the pattern of how we respond to violence with more violence, and how this pattern leads nowhere. Just as when we become compulsive or addictive or obsessive about our own problems, our own anxieties, we get nowhere. We don't grow, we don't develop, and we know we're not getting anywhere. We feel our lives are being dragged down into some pit, into some sludge. So that can happen to us, and indeed has happened to us in many ways as a human race. So self-knowledge has to begin somewhere. And self-knowledge, we could almost say, is the dynamic or the dynamo that drives human development and social development. It's not a simple development because we go two steps forward and one step back. We think we've become very civilized, and then we just realize just how primitive and how controlled by our shadow and our dark side we can be. But the first level of self-knowledge is our own body. A child first begins to experience anything in and through the body, their own body. As a child, the pain and the joys of the body. In adolescence, the confusion and the wonder of the body developing. And all the surprises of how the body and the senses unfold. And then we begin to realize, as in a second stage of self-knowledge, that thoughts and feelings also influence the body. That the way we think, the way we feel, and the attitudes to life that we are developing, the belief systems that we begin to hold, all of these influence us as a whole person. And then we realize that there is a whole new universe waiting to be known within ourselves, to be explored in our minds, in our memories, in our ideas, in our imagination, in our creativity, and through our mistakes, including how to deal with and to how to deal with what reduces our universe, shrinks our world, that's to say the negative states of mind, such as fear and anger and greed, desire, pride and despair. These faults, these eight principal faults, as the desert teachers call them. I gave a series of talks about them recently. And these states of mind contract our world. They make us live in smaller and meaner and tighter little cells. So we have to know how to deal with these. We have to recognize them, identify them, and then we have to deal with them. And that work pushes us into the third stage of self-knowledge, which is when we discover the interior world of transcendence that we call the spiritual, in which even that opposition of inner and outer is transcended. When we really go to a true interiority, and that's what meditation takes us to, a true, authentic interiority, we find that we are transcending this split between inner and outer. So true interiority, which we discover through meditation, for example, is, we discover it through any experience of love or beauty and goodness as well. But this true experience of interiority is very different from just introversion, just being fixated upon ourselves in a narcissistic state of self-referencing and self-centeredness. We begin to see there's a real difference between the ego and the self. And that is the second step. After turning off your mobile phone, the second step is to be aware of this distinction between the ego and the true self. And that can come quite late in life for some people, quite amazingly. I was struck some time ago talking to a student of mine who'd been doing a course with me, and she was probably in her very early 20s, 21, 22 maybe. And she said she came from a non-religious family, and she'd been interested in the course because there was meditation as part of it. And she discovered meditation. She said, "I wasn't interested in religion, really. I wasn't against religion. I just wasn't interested in it. But I did get into meditation." And she said it was a wonderful thing to discover. She said, "I discovered for the first time that I have an inner life." This is a very intelligent, you know, normal, balanced, successful young woman in the modern world, just discovering what interiority meant. So we discover this through an experience of transcendence. It's going to involve some pain, because self-knowledge always involves some difficulties, some pain. We find a unity in things. We see the world through the lens of a personal simplicity that develops through the practice. As we become more simple personally, we begin to see the world as a unity. We find ourselves at peace. We find the peace we are all looking for. Where the spirit is, there is unity, St. Paul says, and where there is oneness, there is peace. So these are, you know, three ways we could think about the stages of self-knowledge. I don't think you write in your diary on the 13th of January, moved into the third stage of self-knowledge today. But anyway, these are little maps that might help to recognize some of the interlocking and often interconnecting phases by which we grow in self-knowledge. I thank thee, Lord, for the wonder of my being. It says in the Psalms, I thank thee, Lord, for the wonder of my being. And this discovery, if you think that little phrase, a little verse from the Psalms, how much is packed into that? Gratitude, the spontaneous arising of a feeling of thankfulness. Not because we've got something, owned something, possessed something, but just through the being itself, the thankfulness of being. The discovery of gratitude, of gift, pure gift, gift that isn't there to manipulate us, to dominate us, to trick us, or to demand something in return, but a gift that is truly a free gift. You know, it's not like, buy two, get one free, because you know it's not free, because if you were to say to the assistant, could I just have the free one, please? They'd look at you as if you're crazy, because you don't get the point. So here's a real gift, something that is truly gracious, truly free. And wonder. Wonder is that awareness of a reality that is beyond our understanding, but not beyond our capacity to experience. That's wonder. I can't explain it, but I know that it's there. I know that it's touching me. I know that it's inside of me. It's like Mary pondering on the mysteries of Jesus, even though she couldn't understand what it was all about. And being itself, I thank thee, Lord, for the wonder of my being, not just my existence in the world, in Hamilton, or wherever. It's not just my existence in this particular historical time and place, but my being. Wherever I existed, my being would be the same. And that, in essence, I think, is the whole human process and the meaning of that process. It's universal, which means, and it's universally necessary, it's universally meaningful and important. So if we die without experiencing it, if we were to die without experiencing the wonder of our being, we would feel that we've missed something. I'm not saying you don't get a second chance. I think, God is the God of second chances. But I think we would realize that we had missed something. We had not used our time well. We would have missed out, in fact, on the whole point of living. So it's universal, but it's also cultural. How we enter and understand this experience is conditioned by the language and the symbols and the ideas of the particular time and place we're living in. We only have to see from what is happening in France recently and in many other parts of the world how different cultural symbols, different ways of understanding the world can clash with each other and create terrible failure of understanding, terrible misperception and terrible violence. But it is also personal, this experience. And the experience itself is only real, not when we talk about it, but when we actually find it in a unique manifestation, which is ourself. Who am I? What Jesus calls the true self. What does it profit anyone if they gain the whole world, but don't ever really get to know their true being? So it's utterly personal and unique. There are as many unions with God as there are human beings. And each has always been, and always will be, every human being who's ever lived, will be and is a unique manifestation of and a unique relationship to God, the source, the ground of being. But at the same time, with all this incredible diversity, there is only one union. And this is made explicit in our understanding of the mystery of Jesus. Why did God become human? That's the great question that Christian faith offers the world. It's a question. I mean, there is an answer to it, many answers to it, many volumes, many libraries, but it's the question that is the most important. Why did God become human? And we repeat that question in the Christian tradition, in different words, in different language, in different ways, in different eras. And we have to find the way to represent that question, to hear it, and to repeat it in our own Anthropocene era. And the first question that it raises is about who we are, who the person is. And that's a crucial question for modern people. Who am I? What is our identity? We have many identities, many credit cards, many email addresses sometimes, many Facebook identities. It's easy to construct identities. At the same time, as we've constructed all these private identities, we have lost privacy, we've lost intimacy, we've lost those qualities that really make identity real. But each person exists not by excluding other people. That's one of the tragedies of our era, is the tragedy of exclusion, condemnation, and violence against people who are different from us. But no one exists by excluding other people. We exist, we become real, we thank God for the wonder of our being by doing the opposite. Not by excluding, but by resisting the temptation to possess ourselves, to hide ourselves within our multiple identities, within our false selves, within the constructed images of ourself that our culture often forces upon us, especially the young.
Hi everyone, you're listening to A Contemplative Revolution, a podcast by the WCCM, about what it means to live a contemplative, spiritual and Christian life while still playing an active role in our modern world. Just a quick reminder, if you like this show, be sure to subscribe. And if you want to learn more about the important work of the WCCM, you can find us online at wccm.org. And now, back to the podcast.
The temptation to be isolated, to see ourselves as, for example, as Christians, as bits of Christ, rather than being wholly included in the person of Christ. In him, there is neither Jew nor Greek, neither male nor female even, neither slave nor free. All of these socially constructed and even gender constructed realities are transcended in the person of Jesus. God becomes human in each one of us. So, that's something to send you to sleep tonight. But a time of retreat like this is an opportunity to turn ourselves briefly, wholly towards this mystery of ourselves and the mystery of God. And to begin to taste again the way those two mysteries interact and illuminate each other. The mystery of ourselves, the wonder of our being, and the mystery of God, who is known through God's own unknowability. And it's in this process of entering into that experience, of turning towards it wholeheartedly, with our attention, it's in that experience that the mystery of Christ will grow stronger and clearer in each of us and for all of us. And turning towards this is what a retreat is about. It demands seriousness of purpose. The word serious shouldn't be taken too seriously. But John Lane used to say, seriousness leads to joy, solemnity leads to frivolity. So when you start to get pompous and solemn and fundamentalist and exclusive and literalist and oppressive and authoritarian and all of those things, then the joy goes out of it. And what happens is you just end up with something very superficial and often, in extreme cases, very nasty. But seriousness leads to joy. And seriousness is expressed in our ability and our willingness to pay attention. You know, if you really give your attention to something, you're being serious about what you're paying attention to and to the act of paying attention. It's deep respect for other people, or for the book you're reading, or for the film you're watching, or for the beauty of creation that you're contemplating, or for the music you're listening to. There's a deep respect there, serious respect for the existence of that person or that thing that leads you to pay attention to it because you're giving yourself to it. That's serious. And it produces joy. The work of attention is at the heart of this whole process. It's this work of attention that actually leads us from one level of self-knowledge to the next. And that's why we can start to meditate at a very young age. That's why very young children can meditate. And very old people, or somebody facing their last days of on this earth can learn to meditate. Doesn't matter where you start. Better, I think, the world would be a very different place if we all started at 4 or 5 years old. And that hit me some years ago when I was in Townsville, when they were starting to teach meditation in the schools there, and they were making a film, and I was wearing my habit, my white habit, and I was in this class of maybe six-year-olds, five-year-olds, it's probably six or seven or something like that, and the teacher said, "Now we'll meditate," and they all jumped into action, and they started putting the meditation circle together, and the little candle in the middle of the room, and the cushions, and they all began to sit around. And there was this little girl who was just staring at me, or my habit, and couldn't take her eyes off me. So I said to her, "Hello, what's your name?" And she didn't reply. She just stared like that. And so after a couple more attempts, I said, "You know, what's your name, and what are you doing?" And she just looked at me and she said, "Are you an angel?" Which completely silenced me. But a few minutes later, I was sitting next to her on the ground. We were meditating together. No doubt she was closer to God than I was. But she was 5 or 6 years old, and she was still at that stage of awareness or development where she would think an angel might come and visit the class on a Tuesday afternoon. And but we were both meditating together, she where she was and I wherever I was. So we begin this work of attention precisely where we are. You begin where you are. So some of you may be meditating, or be very new to meditation, maybe even meditating for the first time this evening, didn't know what you were letting yourselves in for. But that's exactly where each of us starts now when we meditate in a few minutes. We start where we are. And it's a wonderful journey, and it is both certain that we will get somewhere, and it is also unpredictable. So turning in that direction is what a retreat is about, and it does demand this kind of seriousness of purpose that is implicit in any true work or act of attention. Now, let me just say one more thing before we, maybe two more things before we meditate. As we turn our attention towards this thing that we can't name, and that's why meditation leads us into the work of silence, perhaps the first thing we discover is the feeling that we are in the dark. We don't see where we're going in the same way as you would if you're reading a book, or you're planning an event, or a seminar, or you're thinking about a problem that you've got to solve. Then you may not have all the answers, but at least you can sort of see where you're going. But when you meditate, in one sense, it's being in the dark. And there's nothing wrong in that. It's being in the dark because when we meditate, we lay aside our thoughts. Every thought. Thoughts about God. Great insights into eternal realities. Solutions to the problems in your lives. Pleasant fantasies or daydreams. Or old and painful anxieties and fears. Whatever it is, you lay aside. You don't fight it, you don't solve it, you don't try to resolve it, you don't try to cover it up, you don't try and sweep it under the carpet, you just let it go. You lay it aside. It's utterly radical. It's a total act. At least that is what we do, we intend to do. We lay aside all of those thoughts as they arise. And that's why it can seem as if you're in the dark, because you say, people will often say when they're learning to meditate, so what should I be feeling? I don't understand this. What should I be thinking about? You know, I think I saw God during my meditation. Was that all right? You know? And then you say, no, forget about God. And they say, well, I can't, you know. So it is baffling. It should be baffling. Dionysius, in the 5th century, one of the great sort of forces of the early Christian monastic movement, said that the light of this mystery will at first seem like total darkness. There's a poem by Thomas Vaughan. There is in God, some say, a deep but dazzling darkness. There is in God, some say, a deep but dazzling darkness. And we all experience this when we begin to meditate, and as we continue to the journey, we will live with that darkness, but it will make more and more sense. It will become more and more a source of illumination. At first it will feel absurd, and often it feels as if it was a waste of time because we couldn't lay aside our thoughts at all. We just seem to be buffeted on every side by all our thoughts and distractions. So we judge the meditation. We're told not to judge it, of course, but we do. But the judgment of your meditation, the evaluation of your meditation, is just another thought. This is a total act. So you feel your meditation was a great meditation, lay that aside. You feel your meditation was a lousy meditation, lay that aside. And that is the journey. It's the laying aside of all of those thoughts. And this will teach us the meaning of faith. This is faith. Faith is our perseverance on the path of the mystery. Not saying it doesn't matter what you believe, it clearly does matter what we believe, but in meditation, faith is the simple perseverance. So entering that divine ray of darkness feels like, or as if it might be, a kind of unmaking of ourselves, a decreation, a loss of self, or a death of self. And so some people turn away from meditation because it's scary, or because they just don't really want to, don't feel ready for that yet, or they don't understand it, so they're not going to get too close to it. But experience reveals the opposite. And perhaps you have to, later in life anyway, you have to come to meditation through some anguish or some loss or some deep sense of something missing in your life. As a young child, I don't think you need to have that. As a young child, you just slip into it as something totally natural. But later, we have to be pushed into it. And the experience then reveals the opposite. This is not about destruction of ourself, but we are in fact being recreated, being remade. And we emerge from that remaking with some of our defects and problems healed. We find ourselves becoming more whole. So a time of retreat, such as we begin now, is an opportunity to commit ourselves and to recommit ourselves more heartedly, wholeheartedly, to this whole journey of self-knowledge. Self-knowledge which leads us directly and, in a sense, effortlessly, just naturally, into the knowledge of God. And this is what we mean by going deeper. I would like to give up using the word deep for a year, but you keep on coming back to it. It's one of those metaphors you can't really get away from. It's an interesting metaphor. And when we talk about it or use it, we generally use it positively. A deep meaning, a deep truth, a deep person. It implies, when we use the word deep, something out of the ordinary, precisely because it puts us into closer touch with the ordinary. Illusions and fantasies cannot survive depth. As we descend or go into this depth dimension, don't think about it as spatial. It's not a spatial metaphor, really. Well, it is a spatial metaphor, but don't take it literally. But as we go into this depth dimension, our illusions and our fantasies cannot survive. It's another reason why people give up meditation, because we think we need our illusions and fantasies. The complexities also unravel as we enter into this depth dimension because we become more simple. And falsehood and self-deception, as we enter into this depth dimension, have to give way to transparency and truth. So, I just want to say one more thing and one more little suggestion about how you might go into this depth dimension during the retreat, something that might help you. First is the meditation and the mantra. I'll rerun the way of meditation in a minute. But in between the meditation periods, there are some other little exercises, such as the contemplative walking and the contemplative eating and the contemplative showering and contemplative closing of your doors and locking of your doors, above all, so that people don't become too present to you. So all of these things, actually, there's no action in the next couple of days that doesn't have the capacity to open you to the full mystery of the universe. We were to do it totally with presence and with clarity. One other little thing that might help you to maintain and to keep growing in that contemplative state of mind, that attention of being, rather than drifting off and looking for distraction, either on your phone or in a magazine that you see lying around or in a shop that you might find or something, rather than looking for distraction or talking with other people and distracting them, one little thing you can do is a little poem called a haiku. How many of you have written haikus before? Oh, lots. Wow. Oh, you're haiku masters here. Well, a haiku is a three-line, a classic Japanese form of poetry. It's a three-line poem. If you want to do it in a classical format, the first line should be 5 syllables. The second line is 7 syllables, and the third line is 5 syllables, so 5, 7, 5. Now, I'll be honest with you, most of the things that people write, they can be very lovely, beautiful, but they're not haikus. Not only because they are, you don't have to be exact about that if you don't need to be, but they shouldn't be sermons. They should be more like, you know, pictures you take. Everyone's taking pictures now because of iPhones and things. So we become a generation of snappers. So it should be like that. I'll give you three examples by the great 16th century Japanese haiku master Basho. This is the first one. Wrapping dumplings in bamboo leaves with one finger. I'll say it again. I couldn't read it. Wrapping dumplings in bamboo leaves with one finger, she tidies her hair. Oh, look of puzzlement there. What's it about? Okay? So that's it. It's just not about anything. It's just about a woman who was wrapping dumplings in bamboo leaves and with one finger and tidying her hair with the other. Something you might want to take a picture of. Why do you take pictures? Because something strikes you about it. Something beautiful, something unusual, something special. Or another one. Now I see her face, the old woman abandoned, the moon her only companion. Three lines create such compassion, doesn't it? Well, another one here. In the moonlight, a worm silently drills through a chestnut. Or butterflies flit in a field of sunlight. That is all. So, see if you can do as well as those. And you could, if you follow these very meditative guidelines. What you write the haiku about should be an aspect of nature. So, not an idea, not a belief, not a thought, but just something in nature that you are connected with. It should probably will be a fleeting experience that you observed, that you paid attention to. It should be in the present tense. It should be impressionistic. In other words, leave it to the reader to use their imagination. Don't tell them what it's all about. Let them work it out, feel it, as we could with those examples. And don't have any buts and ands or like in it. Just the thing itself. Okay? Not abstract and no title. So the haiku then, as you can see, is an example or an illustration of this quality of pure attention, of pure presence, just in ordinary life. And the extraordinary thing is that the ordinary is so wonderful, so capable of revealing, manifesting the whole picture. And that really is what beauty is. Beauty has always been an object of great philosophical inquiry. What is beauty? Well, the best example, the best definition of beauty or understanding of beauty is, I think, perhaps that beauty is when the whole reveals itself in a part, in a small bit, but it contains and it gives itself through, the whole gives itself through a part. So, if you feel inclined, be present to all of the little events, little happenings that occupy the time of the retreat in between the formal sessions. Don't try not to let your mind start wandering off in fantasy or looking for distraction. Try and be as present as you can. If you've been meditating already for some time, you'll know, of course, that the mantra accompanies you through ordinary activities and ordinary time, ordinary life. So you'll find that probably easier to do. But even then, we all get distracted. So a little exercise like these haikus can just, through a very, very simple capturing of a moment of insight or a moment of a fleeting moment or beauty, it can capture. Don't get obsessive about it. There's somebody sitting up in the back there who once did, once got rather compulsive about haikus during a retreat, and I think must have been producing about 20 perfect haikus a day. Anyway, but enjoy it if you like. And as I say, you don't have to be puritanical about the purity of the format, but try to keep it to three lines and keep it as physical or as sensory as possible. That could help you prepare for your next meditation and give that wonderful experience. It should come from a retreat that reality is seamless. You know, we always break up into compartments the way we live, and often these compartments are sealed off against each other. You know, people at work don't reveal themselves or other parts of their lives to the people they work with, and so on and so on. Or people come home and they don't speak about what happened at work. So we often hide, you know, in these compartments. So, but the time of retreat is to remember that actually life is a continuous, wonderful manifestation of beauty and of God's gift of being. So let's end with our time of meditation. And just before I do, so we don't have to say it again, during the retreat, try to practice an external silence, and that requires some self-restraint. If you have your Bible with you, read the letter of James, which talks about no one can live a spiritual life unless they can control their tongue, which is the rudder of the boat, he says. So try to exercise that self-restraint, and it does literally mean that we don't speak to each other unless it's absolutely necessary, and if we do, we do it in a way that doesn't interfere with other people's silence. And although that might sound, if this is your first silent retreat, that might sound a little artificial or a little antisocial, try it. Just try it. And you'll find that it has the opposite effect. It actually makes you feel more secure and more friendly, more close to the other people around you. So give it a chance. And those of you who have done silent retreats before, many of you, make this the opportunity to go even more into that depth dimension.
You've been listening to A Contemplative Revolution, a podcast by the WCCM. If you've enjoyed listening to Father Lawrence and his podcast, we recommend the course The 8-Bit Problems of Life, available on WCCM.org. Goodbye.